Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All this week on Stateside, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations from 2016. Conversations like the one I had last spring with the Reverend Faith Fowler. She's the executive director of Cass Community Social Services in Detroit. Reverend Fowler and her team had come up with a way to really help homeless and low-income people in Detroit. Tiny houses, each one with a different design, each on its own lot, a true neighborhood within the city. So good to have you back with us, Reverend Faith.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, we're hearing more talk nationally about tiny houses as a way to help homeless people. So exactly how tiny?
So we're going to build houses that are between 300 and 400 square feet. Some will be studio, some will have one bedroom, a few will have lofts, but mostly not.
And how many are you thinking?
We're trying to do 25. It depends on, of course, money and volunteer help. But the first one is slated. The foundation will go in within 2 weeks. The house will take 5 weeks to build, and then we'll start six more after that and build them six at a time, again, as funding is available.
And, of course, certainly one big bridge that needs to be crossed has already crossed because you have the land already.
Yes. We were able to scoop up quite a bit of land. There are 300 vacant lots in the mile around our Cass campus, so there's lots of opportunity for developing more of community.
I'm looking at these pictures, and we're going to have them up on the web so people can see how absolutely beautiful these are. So they're all different. It really has it doesn't have a prefab, everything looks the same, barracks-like look.
Right. We did that on purpose. I know we could build them all the same cheaper, but I'm not sure that's what we want. We want people to have a sense of my home is different and distinguished and attractive. And so we really scoured the internet and went looking at some places to see what would fit in together within our square footage.
Dollars are important. Look at the way I just see the look on your face. What could this project ultimately cost if you take it to where you want it to go with, say, up to 25 tiny houses?
Yeah, so we're looking at $1.5 million, which may sound large to you or small. It costs us roughly $50,000 to do the smallest of the homes and $60,000 to do the largest of the homes. Which is about the third of a cost of a Habitat home in Detroit, for instance, which is larger, usually has a couple bedrooms and a couple bathrooms. But our people, very poor people, homeless or otherwise low income, can't qualify for the mortgages for houses that cost that much. So this deal is even different than any other situation I know of in the United States for homeless people, in that folks will rent for 7 years, and at the end of 7 years, they will own the home. The amount will stay the same all 7 years. It's a very modest amount based on the size of the house. We then will act as the landlord during that time, using their rent money to pay their taxes, their insurance, their water, their security system. And then after 7 years, they won't have to pay rent anymore. And so they'll be able to use that money to pay the things we were having to pay. And so we think we've set them up for success. And what it really means to low-income people is that they'll have an asset, probably for the first time in their lives, that they'll have something they can borrow against, use as collateral, they'll have something they can sell to get something else, they'll have something to leave their family should they die. And all of that is different when I think of the people we work with. They don't even own a bicycle. They don't own a car. So to have a house that gives them that sort of leverage or safety net is really something phenomenal.
What kind of criteria have you set up? Who are you looking for to live in these homes?
Yeah, so they'll be low income, not no income. So some people have criticized us. You can't take a homeless person off the street and give them a home. They're right. You have to have some money in order to pay your light bill, right? Or eventually your taxes. So they'll have to make, and they can make it a variety of ways, about $900 a month. But to have that kind of income and then to own a home is, again, just the American dream in the best way, we think. We've set it at 900 because HUD says a third of your income should be as high as you go on housing and utilities. And so that, you know, leaves them money to buy food and clothing and other things and still have a very nice, as you said, attractive home.
Oh, very much so. You and your team at Cass Community Social Services have already rehabbed an apartment building for disabled homeless and low-income people.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you've seen that changing their lives and what you expect to see when people move into these tiny homes.
Yeah. I wish you could have been there the day we handed out the keys to the largest of the apartments. People were openly weeping. It just, everything was new. Everything was shiny. They were having such a reaction to the privacy and the dignity, and they've mostly remained relatively happy. Occasionally you get somebody who's not, but by and large, it's a wonderful thing to see people gain their independence. The tiny houses will be set up so they, can do things they couldn't do in the homeless programs, like control their own thermostat. They can have a pet for the very first time. They can have company even overnight. They can plant a garden. They can plant flowers. They can, do all sorts of, they can play the music loud or walk through the house naked, which of course they can't do in many of our programs. So we think even during the rental period, they'll be very happy. And then, of course, once they own it, everything will change.
Well, it just changes how you feel yourself. So mm-hmm. that change becomes a seed planted inside
right.
and then grows.
Yeah. So I should point out that not every home will go to somebody who is experiencing homelessness.
Correct.
Some will be for seniors. Some will be for students, especially people who age out of foster care. Mm. Because we want a little diversity in the neighborhood, and we don't want folks to say, and that's where the homeless live.
Hmm? There you go.
And we made it a small part of our community and attached it to the pedestrian campus so they could access services.
And while you're doing this, while you're giving people homes who might not otherwise have them, you're tackling some issues that the city is facing all over. Let's talk a little about that.
Sure. So we have all of this vacant property, which, of course, isn't generating any tax dollars mm-hmm. for the city. So all of a sudden, 25 properties will go back into the tax system. It's also good to have a density in an area, obviously, because then you bring in other services. We're talking about grocery stores and other things, not just for the 25 houses, but the 25 on top of the 325 who are already living with us. And so that creates a sense of goodness for the city. Beyond that, you'll have people coming into the shelters and coming into housing programs with us who will see the success of the people who are now stakeholders in the neighborhood and begin thinking to themselves, I can do it too. There's no reason I can't be a homeowner too. Again, maybe they'll be the first person in their family ever to have owned a home. They'll have to figure out how to clean the gutters like the rest of us. But it's a good learning curve.
Now, how easily do you think this idea could be replicated in other areas in Detroit?
Well, certainly we have plenty of vacant property in Detroit. Tiny home living isn't for everyone. In fact, what I say to people, usually middle class or upper class people would think about moving into a tiny home as, getting rid of stuff and scaling back so that you're living in a very small space. People who are poor are going to think about, well, I have all this space and all this privacy I haven't had before. So it'll be a different reality for folks. We're looking even at a phase two that would involve 2 and 3 and 4 bedrooms on tiny homes that would include families, because these are too small for families. But we knew we couldn't do everything at once.
But you want that vision. It is interesting. Somewhere I saw this posted online and I was reading comments. And the first comment was, well, why do you want to build tiny homes? Why don't you rehab all those vacant homes in Detroit? And, I just got done reading Detroit Hustle by Amy Heimerl. It's her account of rehabbing one of these ruined houses. Mm-hmm. They paid some $400,000.
Right.
It's astronomical, and you can't get home improvement loans for those houses. So for when you say $1.5 million to build 25 tiny homes, that's 2 or 3 derelict homes.
Yeah, and we have rehabbed. We've rehabbed 7 buildings now, apartment buildings, and it's not that we're opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
We simply live in a neighborhood that there aren't many in good enough shape to rehab. And we think occasionally even poor people deserve something new. So we're excited about that.
What is your ultimate vision for this community and the people who will live in these homes?
So I've been at CAST 23 years, and most days I'm happy doing what I do. But I really have started thinking about what we can do systemically to lift people out of poverty. There's been a lot of conversation about income inequality, but next to none about asset inequality. And without an asset, people easily slip into and stay in poverty. And so if we can find ways for them to create a financial safety net, maybe through homes, maybe through savings accounts, I mean, there are many ways to approach it, but I really wanted to do something that had a long-term impact on poor people so that they could enjoy part of the American dream.
Well, you can find out more by going to the Cass Community Social Services Facebook page and follow the Tiny Homes Project. See some of these beautiful pictures, and we'll get these pictures up also on our page at stateside page at michiganradio.org. Reverend Faith Fowler is, of course, the Executive Director of Cass Community Social Services. Always a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
The moon landing, computers, organ transplants. These were some of the truly transformational innovations from the last half of the 20th century. While there are no doubt brilliant minds from Silicon Valley to Boston working on great new inventions, our next idea partner, Jeff DeGraff, thinks something is missing with this generation of innovators.
Recently, a bright young colleague of mine alerted me to a meeting of the minds at a top technology institution. The event was to be a discussion of the breakthrough research and innovative ideas that are flying under the radar. So I joined the online conference just in time to hear a web feed of CIA computer analyst turned whistleblower Edward Snowden. He was giving a rather unremarkable accounting of the authoritarian state of things here in the land of the free. It wasn't that what he said wasn't true. It was just that it's been true since the onset of the Cold War. In fact, for the most part, it's true everywhere in the developed world. Given the omnipresent internet and that candy bar-sized supercomputer in your pocket that lets your service provider connect you to everyone and everything, you'd have to be disarmingly naive to believe otherwise. It's the old hub-and-spoke system run amok. Forget Big Brother. Your credit card company, cyber crooks, and a whole host of peddlers and illusionists know exactly where you are and what you're doing. It sucks, but it's the bargain you made to participate in the complexity of the modern world. And our legal system and law enforcement agencies lack the resources and capabilities to untangle this all-encompassing web. At this conference, I watched a host of brilliant and brave young speakers present dazzling solutions for circumnavigating the stultifying and oppressive tactics of large-scale institutions, governments, corporations, and ideologically based organizations, and yes, even universities. There's a real irony in the fact that the very institutions that brought my generation together are now the ones keeping us apart. But what I found alarming was the conspicuous absence of the idea of progress in the presentations. The conference seemed to be focused only on making things not happen. It was all about fighting pervasive surveillance, intellectual property laws, and the incestuous relationship between corporate and military interests and the media. Perhaps I missed the point of this forum. Maybe it was just a gathering to socialize a litany of complaints against powerful forces, or something darker, such as a global conspiracy. Either way, this was a reactionary response to reactionary forces. If this conference was any indication, the greater conversation has shifted from a way to move forward together to a way to move apart from each other. And that direction locks us in a static state of the present, each playing defense to the other's offense. For good or evil, large-scale innovations can create a shared sense of destiny in communities and cultures. Massive civil engineering projects, fashions like the shoes and haircut stylings of rock and roll, and impossible moon launches. Railing against the machine with no substitute for the common cause replaces the collective us with the triumphant me. While they desire different ends, the means by which they pursue them are the same for both the righteous revolutionaries and the stalwart incumbents. Where is the sense of destiny? What's the moon launch for this new generation of brilliant and capable young people? We could fix the environment we wrecked, cure the big diseases we couldn't, make education equitable and affordable in ways we didn't. While the days of epic aspirations may be best left in the past, it will take more than tiny houses, small cars, and a modicum of ambition to create what must be created now. Sometimes the best way to fight the man is simply to ignore him altogether and to move on to something better and new. Innovation is the only way forward to the future.
Jeff DeGraff is an expert on innovation from the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business and our partner on The Next Idea.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You've heard many stories about Motown through the years, the stories of its stars, the story of the ambitious Berry Gordy Jr. using an $800 family loan to build one of the most impactful record labels anywhere. But there's a side to the Motown story that we haven't heard much about until now. The business side, the entrepreneurial spirit, the hard work, the hustle to get the records played and the company paid. That's the story told in a stunning new book called Motown, The Sound of Young America. It's co-authored by Adam White and Berry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes. Music journalist Adam White was editor-in-chief of Billboard. He has written for Rolling Stone, Radio and Records, The Times, and many more publications. Adam White, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we welcome a legendary name in Motown history, Berry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes, the Detroiter who led Motown's sales team and from 1975 to 78 was president of Motown. Barney Ailes, such a pleasure to have you with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much. Nice talking to you.
This is truly a spectacular book, both the history you tell us, but the unbelievable photos of the people and the artists who made Motown what it is. And I know a lot of these no one's ever seen before. Adam, what was your goal for this book and the story that you really wanted to get out there?
Well, the goal really was to tell, as you mentioned earlier, the stories that haven't been told. I call them the backroom believers. Barney was the king of the backroom believers. These were the people behind the company who helped build that business, without whom it wouldn't have been a business, it wouldn't have been a viable company. And I think, you know, there have been many books written about Motown. I can say this because I've got them all. And I know, you know, the artists have written their autobiographies, many stories have been told, but not these stories. And that's what both Barney and I wanted to do, was to add to the sum of knowledge of Motown, to allow people to understand how it was as a business and how it evolved and how it changed people's lives, both the people who work there and the people who listen to the music. So that and the power of the images, because music is always first, but you can never forget with those Motown stars, the imagery, the how they look, just the style, the class, the sparkle, which made a difference, made everything. And that's what we tried to capture in the book, too.
Well, it's amazing, Adam, you comment in the book how good Barney's recollection was of everything.
And that was the goal, really. I mean, for me, the beauty of being able to ask Barney, who was right at the center of gravity, every question as a Motown fanboy I ever wanted to ask. And because I had an aunt who lived in the U.S. when I was in England, who could send me copies of Billboard, for example, the trade magazine, and I would get to see there was another world to this company and to this business. And that's what drew me in. So when I had the opportunity really to sort of interrogate Barney and ask him all of those questions, who were these people? Who were the promotion guys? Who were the distributors? What was it like? How hard was it? How was it like getting paid? What made a difference? Who were the people who really influenced things? And that, for me, was wonderful. And I hope and think for Barney, you felt the same, because it was kind of like you got to tell me about all these people you knew, who mostly nobody really knew anything about, but were absolutely vital to the story and the evolution of the business.
Barney, you accepted Berry Gordy's offer to join Motown really early on, 1961. Why was that? What was it about Berry Gordy that made you go, yep, I'm joining up?
Well, actually, I had a distributorship in Detroit with another gentleman by the name of Harvey Kahn, Henry Droese, and Johnny Kaplan. I met Berry at a radio station and knew nothing about his background, and we just started talking, and then he invited me to go over to the studio, and I went by there, and we just became kind of close friends before I joined him. Then was a problem of worrying about whether our friendship was going to go. You know, it's very hard to work with somebody. It's when I said, well, let me think about it. I talked to my wife, and I decided that this would be the time to go. A lot of people don't realize is Berry's background of being a writer with Jackie Wilson and before and stuff like that, and the background that I had with before the distributorship, which had a bunch of labels prior to being with Warner Brothers, that I was a branch manager of Warner Brothers Records when they came out by themselves. And before that, I was with Capitol Records and from 55 on. So it just didn't happen overnight. I mean, there's a background of knowing the music business and what to look for and what to do.
And Cynthia, that was absolutely critical to the success of Motown at that point, because Barney had those relationships, you know, with those people from his time at Capital and Warner's and his time at Aurora that gave him the connections and the contacts to help Motown build a business at a critical time. And so there he is, you know, he drops names like Henry Droz and Johnny Kaplan and Harvey Kahn. Those were people whose names I kind of like, who are these guys? And I knew they were vital to the Detroit music business. But when you have an opportunity to understand the roles they played and their relationship with Barney and how that all fell into place to really put fuel into Motown's tank in a business sense, that was absolutely critical.
And understanding as we read the book and get the sense of history, and certainly there's no escaping the issue of race in telling the story of Motown. In fact, you open the book with the 1967 Detroit riots. Barney, your Sicilian background, the sales team you led at Motown was white. Is that, and the connections you had, is that what it took in the early 60s to open the proverbial doors of the industry to Berry Gordy and Motown?
I think it was more the idea of knowing how to work with distributors and radio stations. I mean, the background of collecting the money was the point of being Sicilian. That people weren't never too sure what my connections were with whatever you want to call the organization, mob, Casa Nostra, stuff like that.
Right.
And I never would tell people one way or the other what the connection was. But I started in the record business at Capitol Records in 55 because I wanted to get married at that time and I needed a job because prior to that I was with my godfather in construction. Mm-hmm. But the main point, what I was trying to bring out, was that I started in the back room as a stock boy at 75 cents an hour. And so, and they told me, well, that's the way you'd move up into Capitol Records, which I did eventually. I became, besides assistant branch manager, I became one of the main salesmen. They're working myself up to that, and also a promotion manager in the Capitol at Detroit and the area.
So there you are, Cynthia. There was an Italian-American guy. Before he joined the music business, he was good with cement.
You know, Adam, you share with us in the book an anecdote about Barry and Barney going to dinner at Detroit's London Chop House. Will you recap that for us and what that said to you about that time in history and these two men?
Well, it was a pretty extraordinary story. And I guess, you know, they, as Barney's explained, you know, they were friends, their wives were friends, they had a great personal relationship. So the four of them go off to dinner at the Chop House. And Barney, I know you knew the owner, but he wasn't there that night. So the woman at the desk, when the four of you showed up, two white, two black, and she said, you know, I'm sorry, we don't serve colored people. And Barney shot back, that's good, we don't eat them. And, you know, it's like a music hall line, except that it's not funny.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it wasn't funny at the time.
No.
It was scary.
I bet. You were there.
Yeah, I was quite embarrassed and because I knew the owner of Chop House, and I used to go there quite a bit. I didn't think there would be a problem whatsoever. Then I saw the look on their face, and it's when I heard her say, well, we don't serve colored people. I became very Sicilian.
You went Sicilian on her, ma'am.
And again, you can't believe that people would say stuff like that, but it just reveals much about the times.
Well, it's fascinating to me, and you know, listening to your accent, Adam, we know where you grew up. How important for Motown was the fact that the label was and is so hugely popular in England? I know that Martha Reeves told me when I interviewed her in the 90s how she always got a huge, huge welcome going to England, still does. We have relatives coming next week from London to visit Detroit for the first time. What do you want to see? Hitsville. That's tops. Why is that, you think? Why that connection?
Well, I mean, first of all, the power of the music. The music was extraordinary, no matter by any standard. But in Britain particularly, it carried extra weight because there was nothing like it locally. I mean, I joke that when I was growing up, look, the first Motown record I heard, and it changed my life, was Heatwave by Martha and the Vandellas. And I'd never heard anything like it. Now, if I turn on the radio at that time at home, you know, I could hear the Beatles. So I turn on my TV set, I could see the Rolling Stones. I could care less. You know, they were too accessible. It was too obvious. There was this other thing. What was this music coming from Detroit? Where the hell is Detroit? What is Detroit? What is Motown? And I think for a lot of kids my age, that was something. It was the romance of the distant. So it had an extra cachet. It had something, as well as the power of the music. I mean, you're listening to Heat Wave or Can I Get a Witness by Marvin Gaye or music like that. And it really was unlike anything else you could hear. And it clearly affected the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles covered 3 Motown songs on an early album. So I think there was that devotion to the music that was coupled by the exotic nature of where it came from. And then it started to embed itself into British popular culture. But the interesting thing was that the tour of 1965, when the Motown package tour came over, was not a hit. Even though the Supremes had had a couple of hit records at that time in the UK, nobody knew who these other artists were. Nobody knew who Stevie was or Martha or the Miracles. So the tour was not a commercial success. But within a year, the music had started to take root and build up a following. And so in a way, Britain was late, but then it became more loyal. The love went deeper. And look, some of the artists found more success in Britain. Jimmy Ruffin, for example.
Yes. Well, it was stunning to me as I read your book, Motown, The Sound of Young America, that comment, you quote Mary Wilson, and the impact that it had being in Britain on the Motown artist. And she said, in England, treated like royalty while at home, we weren't black, we were Negroes.
The one thing, a wonderful thing, was connections that I had with EMI, who was very influential in building the label throughout all of Europe. They used to have parties at EMI House with a lot of those pictures where they came from and stuff like that. The idea of sending the groups and all the artists to England on that tour was the same thing that we did in America. Where I got the idea was of sending them across the country and teaching them is when I was at Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers had a television station. They had all the kooky Sunset Strip.
Ed Burns, yes.
Yeah, right. And they sent them around the country promoting ABC and all the shows on Warner Brothers. And then Barry and I sat, and I said, you know, what a great idea if we send the people around. It's going to help me as far as the distributors and radio stations are concerned when they see exactly how great we are. And that's what we did, the same thing in England. And Adam's completely right. It wasn't a winner at the beginning, but it sure became afterwards.
And here's the thing, the relationship that you, Barney, had with EMI and all the international EMI people around Europe also played a role in this book, in that EMI has this fabulous archive of pictures. They kept a proper archive of all of their stuff, paperwork as well as photos, so that when it came to researching and putting this book together, because it was, you know, authorized and approved by Universal Music, which now owns the Motown catalog, we got into the Hayes Library and we got those pictures. And they're some of the ones that have never been seen before. And again, it just shows how international that company was, its impact was, but the source of some of those images was from outside the U.S., and they speak volumes, too.
They're amazing. Well, for anybody who ever felt that wonderful chill down their backbone at the first note of any Motown song, this book is an absolute must. It is Motown, The Sound of Young America, co-authored by music journalist Adam White and Barry Gordy's right-hand man, Barney Ailes, the fellow that turned that chemistry of Studio A into the color of money. It was fabulous to meet both of you. I'm sure that those 18 months of Skype calls were fascinating. You made us feel like we were in on it with you. Thank you very much, Barney and Adam, for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You may remember from your school days that one of the ways geologists measure time is by epochs, which can be seen in changes in rock layers. These tell us so much about what was happening on the Earth at that time. A group of experts thinks it's time we declare a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene. Anthro is the Greek word for humans, which is the big story here. Ben A. Vanderpleim is professor of geology and the environment at the University of Michigan's Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Before we talk about this proposed new epoch, explain that whole concept of epoch. Refresh our memories for those of us that did not follow your course and become geologists.
Yeah, of course, the planet has a very long history. It's a 4.5 billion year old planet. And what we do is we look at the history of the planet by major events that took place in that history. And when we see those events, we break that down into these windows of time. And we have many of them because there's a long history here. And when we see a big change, we design a boundary. And this is one of those times where we're discussing whether or not we should have a new boundary, because the changes today, the recent changes, are sufficiently large that they truly are changing the geology of our planet. These are not just changes that are small in scale. These are very large changes. And that's usually what a geologic event is. It's a global change. And this term Anthropocene is trying to capture the fact that the events today are sufficiently large that they're geologic events and not just human events.
And what's the importance of that name, Anthropocene?
So it's very important to realize, of course, that some of this is technical, meaning geologists like to divide this stuff up, and that may be a little boring, and it probably is a little boring. But really, what's underlying it is not at all boring. That is the fact that we are changing our planet in a very significant way, meaning the atmosphere is changing, the oceans are changing, the land surface is changing. And so while it's a bit of a technical discussion about a new epoch, and even the term epoch is debated, whether it's the right term for this particular case, it's the underlying process. It's incredibly large and important. And that's really what we should think about and understand.
Did I see somewhere in all of this that scientists actually are calling this the sixth extinction in Earth's history?
Yeah, so one of the classic things that we've done in the geologic record is based the subdivision of the record on the history of life. Geologists are able to look at life, well, actually to look at death, yes. Look at fossils, but life and the evolution of life as being the primary way we divided up the geologic record. And so one of the big steps in the record are what we call major extinctions. And extinctions mean a lot of species just don't survive. However, we're in the middle of that. So it's not that something happened 500 years ago or something like that. It is the idea that because of how we're changing the environment, we are also changing the niche for a lot of species. And in doing so, those species go extinct. And that is what extinctions are all about.
When did this start? And you say we're in the middle of it.
Yeah. The debate, of course, is if humans have become a geologic driver, so when did that start? A lot of attention is given to this idea that it's a very recent event that you could say maybe in the 50s. But others have said, well, we should look farther back. We should look at when we started to change the atmosphere. For example, when we started to have the Industrial Revolution, when we started to actually change very much how we are using the surface of the planet and the resources. And yet others have argued that we should look farther back, when humans started to become farmers, when we had agricultural practices that changed the surface of the planet.
So and certainly when this started is certainly under debate.
Absolutely.
But it seems that amongst the scientific community, there's really not any dispute that we are in the middle of intense change caused by humans. What would adopting this new name for this new epoch of Anthropocene, human caused, what might that do to influence our behavior as humans?
Well, the first thing it does is it makes us aware that we have a responsibility for our planet. It's more than just being part of it. We are, in part, driving it, and therefore we should think about stewardship. Now, the best example certainly is this discussion about climate change. When I went to school, and it's a few years now, I still learned that we are heading to a new ice age. And that was because we anticipated that the atmospheric conditions would be such that we would slowly see in the years ahead a dropping of temperature. Well, that has changed. We see that that change in temperature is the other direction. It's actually warming up more so than it has done ever before in this ice age window that we've been in so far. And that's perhaps the best way to recognize that we have changed how the things have shifted. And the climate would have predicted an ice age down the road. It's not very likely that that's in the short term going to happen with ice melting. And so the best way to understand climate change is to look at the record, whereby we have a prediction from the record and we're seeing the opposite taking place.
And yet it's still such a line of division between those who deny and say, no, it's not, and those who are so frustrated with that. And you just wonder, can we as humans, as humanity, ever come together and affect the kind of change that's needed, or is it already too late?
I'm always very much of an optimist in this discussion. The terms like too late or we're doomed doesn't really help us very much. Also, we're pretty clever. Humans are pretty clever. We have a history of doing a lot of clever stuff. We just have to understand what's taking place, and we have to understand it has implications. The challenges of the changes are not just for the rest of the ecosystem, but also for us. We'll see a warmer climate. We will see diseases differently in different places than we've seen before. We see sea level rise. If nothing else, the coastal areas are the first to alert us to that. We have to understand that these changes that are taking place are affecting us directly. And that's really what the discussion should be about. It's not so much about the finger pointing that humans are bad and we should never have done this. The changes are underway, and they're frankly not readily stoppable. The atmospheric change is not something we can change tomorrow. Even if we are very clever, we do all kinds of engineering tricks, at best we can do is adapt a little bit and adjust to it, but the changes are underway, and they'll play out over geologic time, over longer times than you are in my life, and that's the hard thing in this discussion. You and I don't see change that easily. If it's a little warmer, we say there's a cold winter or there's a warm winter. Geology does not work in my and your time scale. It works in its own time scale. But these changes are affecting us. We need to understand them because we have to adapt to them. And I said sea level rise is perhaps maybe the best way to immediately think about that. There's a lot of coastal areas and cities that will be under great pressure.
Now, this new name, Anthropocene, has not been formally adopted, but there's going to be a scientific process. And I mean, what might it take? A lot more discussion before someone officially declares we are in the Anthropocene epoch?
Yeah, that's of course the technical side of it. So there is a committee, and I must honestly tell you, I don't know exactly. Because we've never done something so dramatic as decide on a new epoch. This is a big thing. We usually look back and adjust the record based on information. Now we are in that change, and we have to decide, is that big enough a change to change that record? Down the road, maybe it will take a few more years. I'm sure that the hand-wringing about where to draw the boundary is far from over. But all of us agree, that is those who've studied these topics, that the changes are large enough to truly expect that a boundary like that has a place.
Ben A. Vanderpleim is professor of geology and the environment at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for bringing this expertise and helping us understand this story.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Whenever there's a story of violence that takes over the news cycle, parents face a challenge. How much do you tell your child? How do you answer your child's questions? Do you wade right into what happened and why? Or do you divert them, try to give them something different to think about? For parents of color, these challenges come up with every act of police-related violence, or violence aimed at police officers just doing their job, such as in Dallas or Baton Rouge. Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris is a pediatrician and the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholar at the University of Michigan School of Medicine. She's doing research on the impact that racism and these racially charged news stories can have on children. Such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
It is worth starting our conversation by noticing right out of the gate, you are a pediatrician, but you're a mom, and your son was born in 2012, right about the time Trayvon Martin was killed.
Yes.
That has to inform you in a way that you can't even describe.
Totally. Thank you for asking me that, because even today, I'm shaking thinking about that. At a time where I was pregnant and I should have been ecstatic, mm-hmm. I was fearful. I was so scared to bring a black male into the world because I felt like the world wasn't really ready for him. And then after the deaths of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, those feelings resurfaced, and I couldn't believe I was in that place again. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter how educated I was. It took me back there, and I was scared.
And you're very concerned about the effects of vicarious racism on young people like your son, other young people. What is that, and why is it so worrisome?
That's a great question, because vicarious racism is racism experienced through the eyes of someone else. So someone else experiencing the racism directly can still be transmitted to other people, even if they're not in that close proximity. So it's feeling those effects, even though you yourself weren't directly mm-hmm. discriminated against. And that's why it's so problematic, because even if a kid is in Kansas and sees those events on the news, that could still affect him or her. And that's why I'm so worried.
What kind of effects?
It can cause post-traumatic stress disorder or acute stress disorder. So kids being fearful to go outside, to take out the trash, because they think they'll be next, or not able to sleep or eat or continue in their daily lives as we know it. And that's why that's so insidious, because it's not them directly, but they're still having the same traumatic effects as if it were.
And there really has not been much research done to really look at the impact that racism and these police shootings are having on children, and that's something you want to do. Tell us what your goal is going to be with the research you're going to do.
Exactly. The biggest parallels we can draw is to what we've seen at 9/11.
Yes.
There were a lot of studies done after 9/11 looking at that very thing. We learned that children and some mothers that weren't directly exposed to the events of 9/11 were still having those stress reactions. And that is important because trauma finds its way into our minds and our bodies, and we need to find ways to help children recover from those. So for me, it's important to study that. In my research, I want to know more about how those events can affect children and their caregivers, and more importantly, what can we do to reduce and prevent any negative impact? And my wish is that none of us have to be exposed to racism. Well, none of us live in a society that racism is prevalent. But in the meantime, we need to figure out ways to help our children recover from those negative events.
And when you think of young minds that are just sponges at that point, I think I'm hearing you say what they experience and feel now, let's say as a 5 or 6 year old, they may not realize when they're 46 and they have, you know, ways of behaving and reacting that it comes dates back to this.
Right. And let me tell you, so I've never had any bad experiences with the police at all. But when I shortly after I moved to Ann Arbor, I was in the car with someone who was driving really fast and got pulled over. And I was just in the passenger seat. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the police officer pulled me over, I started shaking. I was like, oh, my gosh, this could be the last day that I live. And for me, who's never had a bad experience with the police, very well educated, lives in a nice neighborhood, it didn't matter. At that moment, I was scared. And so I think that's why it's important for us to be talking about this today.
It's almost like head versus heart
at
war here. It is truly amazing what kids absorb from the world around them. Can you tell us how your son gave you a special window into what parents might be facing?
Yes, thank you. I was walking with my son down the street. It was actually the day that my article was published.
In theconversation.com.
In theconversation.com. And we were walking together, and we saw a baby bird on the ground. And the baby bird was dead. And my son said, Mommy, what happened to the baby bird? And in a clumsy way, I tried to explain to a 3.5-year-old the circle of life and how the baby bird died. And, you know, I wasn't doing that great of a job of it, but I was trying. But then he asked me, did the police kill it? And I was taken aback. It really surprised me because even though I'm thinking about this issue so much and researching it, we don't expose him. My husband and I try really hard to not talk about that in front of him, to not let him watch any TV or media at all about that. But he was still exposed somehow. So what I really want your listeners to know is that even when you don't think children are exposed to racism, they may be. And it's our job to protect them as parents and caregivers.
And as you say, you try to shield your little one from TV. But for the kids out there, when you think of TV and social media, it has really impacted this issue in a way that perhaps wasn't as prevalent when I know when I was growing up. There was no social media. We didn't have cable television.
Exactly.
News was on for a half an hour after dinner.
Exactly. So for kids my son's age, 3.5-year-olds, they should not be seeing TV at all about this. You really should try hard to protect them. But you're absolutely right. The older kids that are acutely aware of what's going on, who are watching the news, you need to sit right there with them so that as they're seeing those images and hearing the stories, you can help them process it right then and there. Social media is more difficult because through social media, these stories can live on forever, even months and years after these things are happened. They're tweeted and retweeted and shared and liked and commented on. So I would say to check back in, you know, frequently with your child and say, hey, are other kids at school talking about this? What are your friends saying? So that you're able to keep your finger on what's happening and what your child is experiencing.
Now, do you bring these conversations into your practice as a pediatrician?
Yes, I really try. And honestly, parents ask me, how do I talk to my kid about this? It's just kind of like other uncomfortable topics. How do you do that? And how do you broach that conversation? So if I'm concerned that, you know, a parent is not really addressing those issues that the kid is facing, I'll say, hey, have you talked to your child about that? Or what do you think? How have you broached that topic? And so that usually creates a conversation. But generally, parents will ask me.
Now, I'm interested. You're clearly having these conversations with parents of color.
Yeah.
What about white parents?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. And I can't say for all parents what those conversations should be. But I think exposure on any level, no matter where you live, no matter what you look like, no matter how old you are, kids are getting those experiences. So I think whether you're a parent of a white child or a parent of a child of color, those conversations still need to happen. So I would say, you know, as a pediatrician myself, I say, you know, we need to be talking about this. It's uncomfortable. It's not going to make us feel great doing it, but it's so important.
What do you hope will come ultimately out of the kind of research you're going to do, looking at the effects of racism on youngsters?
Well, there are four key things that I want parents to walk away from this article, from this news piece, from my research. And the four things really are to seek the mental health care that they may need, because they may personally be affected by it. And you can't help your kids until you help yourself. So being supportive to your friends and colleagues that may be going through this too. Mm-hmm. They're having a tough time processing it, making sure they go and get the mental health care that they need. But two, also, again, talking to our kids and making sure we know what they know and we can dispel the rumors and alleviate some of those heightened fears. We need to be on the pulse of what's happening with our children. And the third thing is, if our children are having disruptive things in their lives, such as these events, we need to talk to our pediatricians, our primary care providers, our mental health providers to help us. We can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. We need to share this with our medical providers so that they know what's going on too. And the last thing is to limit the exposure as much as we possibly can. I know it's so hard, but we have got to try to do it.
I know we heard people say it after 9/11, turn off the TV. Exactly. Over and over when you'd see the planes hit the towers.
Exactly.
Your three-year-old doesn't realize that that's a tape replay.
Right. Exactly. They think it's happening again and again.
Great advice. Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris, pediatrician and the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholar at the University of Michigan School of Medicine. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.